despite all of the persecution in the early church, the Christians still, on average, had the longest life expectancy. You know why that was? Because they took care of their sick, their elderly, their poor, their infirm. And so, and a lot of people were converted by that.
Welcome to the Christian Emergency Podcast, a podcast for Christians spooked by the growing hostility in the culture today. We will tackle a range of topics from current events, persecution, missions, and what it means to be the church. You will gain valuable insights from those experienced working with persecuted Christians around the world, insights we all need to chew on in these strange days. Together, may we help the church stand. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Christian Emergency Podcast. I'm Andy Coleman, your host, and today we are going to be turning a page back in history and looking at the early church, the ancient church, especially how did they encounter persecution? How did they respond to persecution? What did that look like, and what can we as Christians today glean from that experience? Whether we're Christians in the Western world who are seeing pressures rise around us culturally, or maybe we're Christians in countries that are already subject to open hostility and persecution, I think there's going to be nuggets for us to take away from this inquiry. And to help us do that, we are joined by Professor Louis Marcos. He is a professor at Houston Christian University, formerly Houston Baptist University. He's the author of, I believe, somewhere around 25 books. And he's covered some fascinating material, including the early church, ancient Rome, ancient Greece, C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, apologetics, and a lot more content, all of which is just gold to us here at the Christian Emergency Alliance. We're thrilled to be joined by Professor Marcos, and thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Andy. I'm always ready to learn from the past, especially our ecclesiastical church past that we seem to have forgotten.
Yeah.
And by forgetting, we just make the same mistakes all over again.
Well, we totally agree. We think that Christians today have a gap between their knowledge and what they need to know about Christian history, or the history of persecution, the history of our church, ecclesial history. There's so much for us to, so much good, healthy context for us to benefit from. And as we were chatting before the show started, it's almost like we have to reclaim this muscle memory as a body, as a global body. And I'm grateful that there are men and women like you who have taken a lot of time to study these and really develop insights and thoughts that we can benefit from. So to help us appreciate that more, could you just tell us, I introduced you briefly, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and the work that you do?
Well, great. Well, my name is Lou Marcos. I'm a professor of English and scholar in residence. I've been working at HBU, now HCU, for 32 years. My specialty as an English professor are the Romantic and Victorian poets, which I still love and teach. But I also do anything that has to do with ancient Greece and Rome, with Dante, and anything with C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, and also anything with apologetics and education. The last 15 years, Andy, my biggest focus has been classical Christian education. We both just came back from the Association of Classical Christian Schools meeting in Pittsburgh, and this is an incredibly important movement that is trying to take back the culture for Christ. And it's an ironic one, Andy, because if somebody asked me what is a classical Christian school, my answer is what Jesuits used to be like when they were worthy of themselves, but from a more evangelical point of view. But we're trying to, one of my passions, I wrote a book called From Achilles to Christ, Why Christians Should Read the Pagan Classics. And I believe that we can not only learn from our Christian past, but we can learn from our pagan past, because all truth is God's truth. And God does speak to us, not just with special revelation, as he does in the Bible, the prophets, Christ himself, but through general revelation, the way he speaks to all people. And we can learn from these things, obviously, so that we don't make the same mistakes, but so we can also understand what is the true nature of God, man, and the universe. And Andy, a good way to begin that just strikes me as I think about what we're going to talk about today, I don't know about you, but it often shocks me and confuses me. For instance, in China, Why does the government persecute the Christians? Christians in general are good citizens. They're not running around stealing, getting drunk, going to prostitutes. They are honest people. They tend to pay their taxes. They want to help their fellow man. I mean, most of them are not revolutionaries. So why don't they like Christians? And it helps if we go back to the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire, as if you compare it with other empires, was actually quite just, was well run, was well administered. Why did they not like the Christians? Even there was a letter writer named Pliny who wrote to an emperor to tell them that the Christians were good. They rose up early. They sang hymns to God. They didn't steal. They did all these things. I think the number one reason that they hated the Christians is because the Christians wouldn't get with the program. From the point of view of pagans, and that's also true of atheist communists, it's also true of liberal progressives, Christians are annoying to them. We seem obstinate because we won't just go along with what they think is such a wonderful idea, Pride Month and rainbow flags, whatever it happens to be, pinching a pinch of incense to the divine cult of the emperor. What is such a big deal, folks? Get with the program. Marcus Aurelius was an emperor in the second century who was a great Stoic philosopher. He wrote a book called Meditations that is still read today, still worth reading today. In fact, I like to say that if Christ didn't rise from the dead, I'd probably be a Stoic. It's the next best choice if Christ did not rise from the dead. But of course he did. But what's fascinating is the Meditations is like 150, 160 AD. So Christianity's been around for a while. But in the whole book, Marcus Aurelius, who led a persecution on the church, only mentions Christians once. And he says it, this is basically what he says. What a wonderful thing it is to lay down your life for Rome and for what we stand for. Except, of course, for the Christians who do so out of mere obstinacy. That's all I can see, that we are up. And if you just listen to what progressive, you listen to an Obama or something, listen to what they're saying, they're going, why won't you just help me out? I want to do good things. Who cares if babies are killed? I mean, we got to understand the mind of the unbeliever who just doesn't get Christians live in a certain way and believe that we're held accountable to certain things.
Yeah, I think that's a great introduction to all of this. And there's strong parallels between what the early church was experiencing and what we're experiencing. In so many ways, biblical Christianity is seen as a roadblock. We just won't get with the program. And sometimes we're the very last roadblock standing between authoritarians and their desired end state. So they get perplexed and they can react violently. They can bureaucratically snuff out that opposition. They can do so much. But I am so grateful to have voices like yours, particularly because in so much, especially in the West and in the United States, so much of the cultural winds, the pressures are to ignore history. It's almost there's this dedicated campaign to carve off history from students, from people. And even as Christians, we're not savvy to this either. But we need to be able to look back and reflect on what has happened before to anticipate what happens tomorrow, in addition to knowing how to respond today. So it's so important for us to strengthen ourselves as a church, as local churches, as Christians, as families, as the global church, as the body of Christ, to dust off some history books, good history books. Listen to people, scholars such as yourselves, who have spent hours, years, decades digging in and learning all of this and refining these insights. So I'm profoundly grateful for the perspective you share. Also, as we start this inquiry into the early church, the ancient church, and their experience with persecution, can you just describe for us what, in your mind, constitutes the early church?
First of all, just to give a nice biblical frame for all of this, for why we need to study history, particularly we're about to talk about the martyrs, the persecutions. Think about Hebrews 11, the great Hebrews Hall of Fame, right? Talking about the great forefathers of our faith. It says, and he lists, right? Whether it's Paul, whoever, he goes on and lists all the people that proclaimed Christ, but also the people that were, fed the lions and sawed in half and all that sort of stuff. We must not forget them, for they are the great cloud of witnesses that surrounds us. So when we use the word early church, we tend to mean the early church from Christ to Constantine. So we're talking about, you know, the resurrection is probably about 30 AD, and Constantine ends the persecution of the church year 313. This we call the Edict of Milan. So for about those 300 years, that's the early church when the church is still being actively persecuted by Rome. They have not yet become insiders, if you will. Another name for the early church is Anti-Nicene. The Nicene Creed was formulated in 325. Just a little bit later, Constantine called this meeting. Anti, when it's spelled A-N-T-E, means before, like the antebellum South means before the war, before the Civil War. So Anti-Nicene are the, or this is, in other words, this is even a little bit before Athanasius. It's quite a bit before Augustine. These are people like Irenaeus, Tertullian, Clement, and Origen, names that are not necessarily as well known today, but should be, because these are really the early formulators on which giants like Athanasius and Jerome and Augustine will actually stand.
Well, thank you for that introduction to the early church. And yeah, we do need to familiarize ourselves more with these figures, not just from the early church, but throughout our Christian history. But as we look at their experience, really before Constantine or up until the time of Constantine, what did persecution look like for the early church?
Again, it's interesting that in the beginning, the Romans did not originally persecute the Jews, persecute the Christians. If you read Acts, the original people persecuting were the Pharisees and whatnot. They were upset. The Romans partly saw the Christians as a sect of Judaism and nothing more. It's not really until Nero that we have a persecution of the church because there was a great fire in Rome, possibly set by Nero himself to clean out real estate so he could build his giant conspicuous consumption house. And it was about 65, we get the first persecution of the church. And that's when Peter and Paul were both martyred, just a little bit after Acts ends. There's a lull. At the end of the first century, you have Domitian. Domitian is the second big persecution of the church. And that's when John was put in prison on the island of Patmos, sort of exiled there, where he wrote Revelation before he was released. Then the second century, we have lots of sporadic persecutions breaking out. There are two more major persecutions. And then in the third century, there's another five persecutions, some of them major, some of them minor. But the number one reason that was pushing the persecution, well, let's two things, okay? First of all, again, sometimes we think of the Romans as absolute bad guys. But when you really look at the martyr accounts, the people that were the most bloodthirsty were not the Roman leaders, were not the centurions, were not the magistrates. It was the people in the crowd who were looking for a scapegoat, like a witch hunt or something like that. There's a bad crop, we're losing, whatever. Must be those Christians. Let's get a scapegoat, right? But the more technical reason why the emperors felt the need to put them to death if they would not recant is that the Romans actually practiced religious toleration. You can worship whatever gods you want in any combination. You can have your little, you know, household gods and all that. But part of the, you know how we have this civil religion in America, salute and things like that? Well, the civil religion in ancient Rome was emperor worship. And part of what was expected of you as a citizen, sort of pay obeisance, was to take a little pinch of incense and throw it in the fire before the divine Caesar, the divine Augustus. And they just couldn't understand why the Christians wouldn't do that. It's like, look, have your God, but just do this. Make us happy, right? Stop standing out against. But obviously, as Christians, we can't do that. Thou shalt serve the Lord thy God and him only. Right? That we do not allow syncretism. That means putting together all the different religions and taking the parts that you like, although there are many Americans who do that. But that is not what Christianity teaches, okay? God is a jealous God. He is, you know, a hero Israel, the Lord thy God, the Lord is one. You shall, you know, have no God before me, worship the Lord thy God. So that was the technical reason. And when you read a lot of the accounts, a lot of time the magistrates actually give the Christians a chance to recant. Look, just recant, do the little incense and go home. And again, that's that, why do we, I mean, again, just the best example of this today was when Obama first brought out his Obamacare. If he was smart, he would have realized that he was going to get lots and lots of support from Catholics in general, whether they were liberal or conservative Catholics. Catholics tend more towards that than Protestants, especially evangelicals. And he would have had no problem, but because of his radical, whatever, progressive stuff, he decides to put in that bit about abortion and about companies having to pay for abortions and things like that. And he ended up alienating lots of otherwise Catholic supporters. But this, and of course, as evangelicals, we can go too far too. We're all sinners, okay? But the point here about persecution is sometimes those in leadership just have a blinded view of what citizenship and obedience means. And if you won't do that, then again, we need to persecute you. Why can't you just be nice and get on? Why can't you use preferred pronouns? That's maybe the best example for this moment right now. Why, you know, Jordan Peterson, not even a believer yet, right? I'm not going to do that. Okay? But the believers are not going to do that because we have certain beliefs about the nature of God, of man, of the universe, of reality. And so that was the real crunch as far as the government went, that the Christians were refusing to participate in, again, what we would call today civil religion.
Yeah, and I think that what you described mirrors so much of what we see among those that are more heavily persecuted today, and we could also learn from their experience. I appreciated how you pointed out that early on, most of those pressures and persecution for the early church came about locally. It was really community-based persecution, which we see in countries like Pakistan, Afghanistan, where it'll be your own tribe, it'll be your own family that might come after you. Not so much the state. The state generally was wanting to keep the peace, so they might intervene to restore order and to try to make you go back into your old faith if you were a convert to Christianity. But I see a lot of parallels between what happened then, community-based uprising, or some people describe it as bottom-up persecution. Whether it's community-based persecution or government-based persecution, there's a lot for us to learn. And I appreciate the nuance that you applied from the Roman Empire.
We will return to the podcast momentarily, but first, a word from our sponsor. Being a Christian today can be hard. This is true if you live in a heavily persecuted country like Iran or areas where cultural pressures against Christians are growing fast, like America and Europe. Fortunately, none of us have to stand alone. We are part of a giant body, one huge spiritual family that spans the globe. That is the church. The Christian Emergency Alliance is committed to helping the church stand, regardless of the pressures to come. As a 501c3 nonprofit, the Christian Emergency Alliance strives to help our spiritual family when persecution hits. We also strengthen the church by supporting ministry that makes Christ famous, defends biblical truth, and prepares fellow believers for challenges ahead. You have the opportunity to make a huge impact in this work today. Become a monthly financial ally of the Christian Emergency Alliance by signing up at christianemergency.com. Your support of $25 a month or a gift in any amount will bless those who need help in these darkening days. Help the church stand today, tomorrow, and in the days to come. Register today at www.christianemergency.com. And now, back to the show.
And I want to look at how did Christians respond to this persecution? You've already touched on this a little bit. You pointed out that all they had to do in some cases was do this pinch of incense to Caesar, this Caesar worship, and this simple act they refused to do. They were faithful not to comply with this that conflicted their obedience to Christ. They didn't go for that. But how else did Christians respond when they were facing these pressures, whether based in the community uprisings or from government authorities themselves?
I will tell you, first of all, and this is very interesting, when I started really reading all the primary documents, we have no example of the Christians ever fighting back. Now, if they could escape, they would. That was because you didn't run after martyrdom, right? If you could escape, you would. But if you were caught, you followed the law, basically. And again, Andy, you start reading the early documents, first, second, third century. Those Christians took the Sermon on the Mount very literally, okay, in terms of turn the other cheek and other things. Now, I have to interject this here because this has caused a lot of controversy. I know a lot of good Christians, evangelicals and stuff like that, who now, I hate Constantine. I blame everything bad about the church on Constantine because then we on pacifism. Okay, let's make something very clear, okay? I mean, There are various interpretations of this, but basically, if you read the Bible carefully, how do you put together eye for an eye with turn the other cheek? Eye for an eye is God's justice, and it's justice that duly appointed authorities are supposed to exact. That is the government that does not bear the sword in vain. Justice is eye for an eye, but God's mercy is turn the other cheek. An example, a hard one. Let's say somebody kills someone in my family. My job as an individual Christian, as much as I am able, is to forgive that person, turn the other cheek, right? That doesn't mean I give them my other child to kill, okay? But it means I am supposed to try to give forgiveness. But the government that does not bear the sword in vain, that is supposed to exact justice, their job, and that depends how you read the Bible, is either to put them in prison for life or execute them. I might get into death penalty. But the point is that the government must do that. Okay, now, why am I telling all of this? Before Constantine, yes, Christians practiced what we would call passive resistance. They did not fight back. They did not do a revolution. Why then, after Constantine, do you suddenly have Christian soldiers and just war theory talking about when it's right to fight? Look, before Constantine, it was kind of easy on us. We could always individually and as a group turn the other cheek because we had these nice pagans protecting us from the barbarians. But once we became the people in charge, it was now our job to protect people from the Vikings, the barbarians, the Germans, whoever the barbarians are. That is their job. And that is why Augustine is an architect of what is called just war theory. And again, it's not because Constantine put us into bloodthirsty Christians. It's because something changed. And now we have to figure out, and we're not always saying we came up with the right answer, but now we have to figure out what our role is as leaders while still remembering that our role as individual Christians is to turn the other cheek and seek peace and reconciliation and offer our forgiveness and offer our mercy. So again, in those early days of persecution, they turned the other cheek. They would try to escape, but they wouldn't run after it. But once they would, now some of them recanted, okay, and then came back later. Some recanted, but others stayed strong. And they often said things like, "I accept your authority, right? I look up to you as an authority, but I cannot do this, right? The God I serve does not allow me to give obeisance to another deity. I will look up to you as a leader, and I will do it again." They were good citizens. The Christians did not revolt. We don't have any examples of that. And again, there would often be a dialogue and whatnot. There are also many cases where the early apologists like Justin Martyr, Athenagoras, and Aristides actually addressed people like Trajan and Antoninus Pius and Marcus Aurelius and addressed them to explain why Christians are good citizens. I don't know if you know this, Andy, but in the early church, Christians were often accused of two things. One was incest. Right, we call each other brothers and sisters, and the other was cannibalism because they apparently ate the body of Christ and drank the blood of Christ. And a lot of these martyrs try to explain, no, we do not do that. Okay, we do not practice incest, we do not practice cannibalism. But again, we cannot give obeisance to the emperor as if you were a deity.
That's right, and we were also accused of being atheists because we didn't participate. Yeah, we didn't participate in emperor worship, so we were atheists. And yeah, and you're right. So this does get more developed as Christian history passes and these Christian conversations among leaders and officials happen as we're trying to be faithful to the scriptures and our responsibilities to one another. So much later on in Christian history during the Reformation, you have some princes that have standing armies that they become converted. And they see their people starting to be persecuted for being Protestant Christians. And that stirs up this conversation. Well, what do I do? How do I faithfully carry out my responsibilities as a magistrate in this type of a setting? But of course, that's far removed from the situation that the early church was facing. And they were responding as you described. What would you, when we just look at the early church, what would you say that the early Christians did best in their response? And are there any cautionary tales that you look at their response And you're like, we can learn something from that. Maybe we can have grace because they were doing the best that they could. And they only had so much guidance and experience in history themselves. But what did they do best? And what do you look back on and say, we can learn something from this and not repeat that?
I tell you, what they did best, I'm sure people, apologists say today, I haven't seen too many atheist hospitals or atheist orphanages, et cetera, right? I mean, the Christians sort of invented them. There were no places for the poor. They just died on the street. Even the pretty good pagan philosophers didn't care too much about the poor. I mean, the Christians, they were the ones that stopped the gladiatorial matches. The Christians were also the ones that stopped infanticide, because they would often just leave the babies out to die of exposure. And the Christians would take those babies in, right, and raise them. I mean, very kind of like Mother Teresa does today. Well, she's dead now, but that's what she used to do. And so what they did is they showed mercy. Also, okay, here's an amazing fact, Gibby. Despite all of the persecution in the early church, the Christians still, on average, had the longest life expectancy. You know why that was? Because they took care of their sick, their elderly, their poor, their infirm. And so, and a lot of people were converted by that when they saw what the Christians did. In fact, a little bit of that, because a lot of people misunderstood, Constantine did not make Christianity the official religion. It was a guy later named Theodosius. And one of the reasons he did that is because there was this kid named Julian the Apostate, who was the first PK in history, rebelled against his Christian family and tried to take Rome back to paganism. And he realized he wasn't winning because the Christians were doing such good works that he tried to get his pagan leaders to do good works. And they always resent. It's really kind of funny. But anyway, the other amazing thing they did, and this is true if you watch the movie Quo Vadis, which is a very good movie about the persecution under Nero from the 50s. As far as we know, the Christians were always singing, whether they sang hymns or chorus songs, you can decide when they raised their hands. But they were singing. And a lot of times when the Christians went to their death, their martyrdom, the guards, the pagan guards, were so impressed by their courage and their integrity that they converted to Christianity and more often than killed themselves. So the witness they gave was amazing. Sometimes, though, they could be a little bit legalistic. Okay, there was almost a heresy in the church. During about 250, there was a guy named Decian. This was the seventh persecution. It was Empire I, particularly bad, and a lot of Christians started recanting. And this bishop named Novatius said, if you recant, you can never be restored. You can never come back. Wow. And later on, thankfully, that was declared a heresy, Novatianism. It was declared heresy by Cyprian, who later was martyred himself. And then they were more serious than we are. If somebody recanted and they came back, they had to show real penance, real change, all of it. They went through a process of bringing them back in. Okay, but it's very important that it was decided that sometimes they were a little bit too legalistic and thinking there's a non-forgivable sin. The other thing they did, which I think is strange, and I can understand it maybe biblically, is a lot of Christians believed that after you were baptized, you cannot do any sort of major sin. It's kind of strange. That's probably why Constantine was not baptized until his death. A lot of people think he must have been hypocritical, but a lot of times they didn't. And it's hard to tell when they finally stopped saying that. I mean, there's still that distinction in Catholicism between mortal and venial sins. But again, at least what it means is they took very seriously the behavior of Christians. They talked about it as the way of light, the way of darkness. And so, like, again, there is a tendency sometimes to be a little bit too legalistic. But there was a correction there by the end.
Well, thank you for that. That's very good for us. Earlier, you also mentioned how many times these persecutions were sporadic. It didn't necessarily engulf the entire country or the region, but they would flare up in different parts. And I'm just looking at the trends. I'm looking at things today, and I think that that could very well be possible as we're looking at things really seem to spiral out of control in some regions more than most. So, for example, there could be a sporadic event in someplace like California, whereas in a place like Oklahoma, it's less likely. But you could see sporadic things coming on in the next few years, the next few decades. But when that happened for the early church, were there any indications that that was about to brew, that that was about to ignite? And if so, what were some of those telltale signs?
It seems to me, from what I've read, it often breaks out when there is trouble. There is a famine, there is a war that maybe Rome loses. Whenever things were unstable, let's think of today, spiraling inflation. Whenever things are unstable, there is this desire, a scapegoat. And you can read it in the City of God, because in 410 AD, Rome was sacked. The first time Rome had been sacked in 800 years. And in the City of God, Augustine talks about how the pagans were trying to blame the Christians for the sack of Rome. And he just goes back and says, oh, really? So where were your pagan gods when Troy was sacked and when Rome was sacked the first time? And when this happened, he sort of exposes the nonsense of it. But people do that. I mean, a good example is, as conservative Christians, we can be guilty of that. When there was that hurricane that destroyed New Orleans, when Katrina, I think it was called, there were a lot of Christians who appointed themselves the decider of what the cause of that was. Okay, now, there is a relationship between sin and these things, but it's not really ours to determine that's was the reason, whatnot, so we have to be careful of that as well. But yeah, interestingly, during the Roman persecutions, as bad as the was in Rome itself, it was always worse in the margins of empire where proper law and order was breaking down. So that would be Lyon, France, Carthage in North Africa, what is today the coast of Turkey. The persecution was always worse in the edges than it was in the center. And something we should remember, something you alluded to earlier, my grandparents were all born in Greece, and Greece had a terrible civil war, just like China did and Russia. And you know what often happens when there's a civil war like that, especially when it's between right and left, whatever you want to say, communists and fascists or whatever? A lot of times what happens is peasants who are not political, let's say I'm a peasant and you're a peasant, and neither one of us could even define the difference between a communist and a capitalist. But I have always envied or coveted the extra acre of land or the extra two cows that you have on your farm. And so when the communists come to power, I say, my neighbor, I heard him. He's a capitalist. You see what I mean? A lot of times it's old envy. We're even seeing this in America. Old, nasty sort of envies that rise up and attack each other in the name of all of those troubles in Northern Ireland. I don't think they were specifically about Protestant and Catholic. They were about different paramilitary groups that identified with that. But the religion was only a cover to make it seem a little more appealing than just raw power and political revenge and covetousness. So it's important to remember these dynamics have always been with us from beginning to end.
Great. Yeah, excellent. That's good for us to chew on. And I'm going to be pondering that in the way it applies in other contexts as well. One of the things that I'm considering when I look at the early church and consider them in context of persecution is this topic of risk, a willingness to take risks, to be faithful, and how to do that in an environment that's hostile or increasingly growing in that direction. In your readings and your studies, what have you learned about the early church's willingness to take risk, and what did that look like?
First of all, I can't remember where I read this, but I once read a really good article saying that Americans, as opposed to Europeans and other people, Americans have a very bad understanding of the word risk. That's why we have so much litigiousness in our country, which is not the case around the world, because everybody has to be at fault. We just can't accept the fact that bad things just sometimes happen, right? People die. We don't have to sue the doctor. Sometimes people die. People make mistakes. Good Lord, could you imagine if they sued professional basketball players because those bozos can't make a foul shot? They're paid millions of dollars and they can't practice. I mean, again, as Americans, we just overdo it. We always want somebody to blame. So let's just remember that we ourselves, as opposed to Europeans and others, have too much risk. But again, the ancient Christians took calculated risks. They did not run out and shout things in the street. Okay. They did have their home churches. They were wise. They were discerning. They remember what Jesus taught us, be as wise as serpents, but as innocent as doves. So again, they did not do that. Origen, who would become an early church father, when his father was martyred, he was so full of passion that he tried to run out. He was like 12, tried to run out of the house to martyr himself. And the only way they could stop him is his mother stole his clothes from him. And his natural shame prevented him from going out. That was wrong. Okay. But generally speaking, they recognized that was wrong. You try to work within your community. Remember, our job is to make disciples of all nations. And what they focused on was quality over quantity, maybe the best thing I could say. And they did hold each other accountable. They could forgive. Like I said, sometimes they were too strong, but they took what we would call church membership. They took it very seriously. And they did hold together. And again, if they could, they would leave. But if they were asked directly to reject Christ, they wouldn't do it. Because they understood that, you know, there is a point when you just have to stop, right? And whatever the cost, you have to give in. But you don't go running after it. You show some of the folks know that the Christians apparently came up with a secret symbol to identify each other, and it was the fish, right? You've seen it on a lot of people's bumpers, the fish. Hopefully you didn't see it on someone's bumper as they were cutting you off. Please drive like a Christian if you're going to wear that symbol. But, you know, the fish is Ichthus, Jesus Christ, Son of God, Savior. And we think that if I wasn't sure if you were a Christian, with my foot in the sand, I would draw an arc. And if you were a Christian, you would finish that arc so it looked like a fish. So it does seem that they at least had that symbol as a way to identify each other rather than rushing out like fools. And, you know, again, they showed discretion or prudence. And I think we need to learn that, right? And another thing, we also need to learn, like a lot of Christians, and I tend to be like this, to be 100% on the side of the underground Chinese church and have disdain for the, you know, the government church called the Three Self Movement. Well, you know, there's something to be said that the Christians tried to balance it. If they could work with the government, they would, but always to a limit. And we have to decide how far we're going to go. And that's not always an easy decision. When we work, even right now, if we work together with the government, NGOs and things like that, how far can we go? When do we need to pull back? A good example are classical charter schools. Now, charter school means it's public, right? So they can't be openly Christian, but many of them are Christian. And a lot of times they will have teachers that are not just Christian. They will have teachers that are Mormons or Muslims sometimes. Now, obviously, theologically, there's an incompatibility there. But at least in terms of teaching our children goodness, truth, and beauty, I do think that they're now, you know, I no longer like Mitt Romney. I think he's done terrible choices. But earlier, before he showed his bad side, I thought to myself, you know, as a Christian, I think I could vote for a Mormon because in all the things he would do as a president, I think it would be compatible with Christianity. Like I said, he's done things now that make me move away. I remember theoretically thinking about that, whatever that was, 8 or 12 years ago. I thought, you know, again, we need to understand when an alliance is okay and when we need to be careful that it doesn't water down our doctrine.
Yeah. Well, that's great food for thought for us. As you look back at the church, besides what we've already discussed, are there two or three things that you would like to see Christians today extract from that ancient Christian experience? Are there some things that we could do today that, born off the lessons of the early church, that would really help us in areas that we seem to be weaker today?
First of all, we need fellowship. We need real fellowship, the breaking of bread. We do need an accountability structure. I'm at a Baptist church, but lately we've become really a Reformed Baptist church, which is basically Presbyterianism disguised as Baptism. But you know, I mean, I've there's a lot to be said for the elder structure that we now have. I think a lot is to be said for that. And the early church understood that authority. Of course, the early church had elders and bishops, right? So they were probably a little more like Episcopalians than like Presbyterians. But still, that the need to help each other out and lift each other up was very important. They seemed, from what I could read, to take joy. They weren't always sitting around waiting for the end of the world, right? You know that when Paul, I think it's Thessalonians, when Paul says, if you don't work, you don't eat. It seems to be the context of that was that the Thessalonians were expecting the return of Christ any day. And so they just gave up and sat around waiting. That's really the context. So we need to keep working. They were building the kingdom. They weren't always. Now, at the same time, they were not doomsday people. When you read the martyr accounts, they were all very aware of the fact that their real enemy was not Rome, but Satan. They were all aware of the real spiritual war. That doesn't mean look for a demon behind every stone, that kind of stuff. But they understood that this was a spiritual battle. But they still lived their lives. They did things. They worked. They took care of people and things like that. They didn't just sit around waiting for the end. They built things. They built church. Do you know by 300, just before the 10th and worst persecution called the Diocletian persecution, by 300, 10% was Christian. Do you know that? 10%. So their slow work of seed building and disciple making was, by then they had built churches, they had lots of printed Bibles and things. So it is possible. And again, as much as you are able to work with the government, but know the limits. Okay. For me, if I was a public school teacher, I understand that I can't, teach the Bible theology in my class. But I also understand that I can't call a he a she. I can't just say something that is a lie to God's creation of man and woman. So everybody's got to find their limits in there. Whereas me, I would be okay if there was a girl and she wanted me to call her, by a name that sounds more like a boy. I mean, a nickname is a nickname, I don't mind. But to call a she a he, you're suddenly making a statement about reality that flies in the face of God's design. I would think that's too much. But again, people think of Nicodemus. Nicodemus obviously did not speak out directly or he would have been thrown out of the synagogue. But he did all he could to try to get Jesus a fair trial, probably at risk to himself. So again, that's partly, it's just like I love homeschooling and classical Christian schools, but at the same time, I don't think every Christian is called to do that. Other Christians are called to be salt and light in the public school as much as you're able to reinforce. I mean, again, a lot of it is God working on your private conscience. And again, discernment's not always an easy thing, Andy.
Yeah, it's not. But discernment's difficult, especially in cultures that are swimming in chaff. So much of this feels like a psychological operation where there's so much that's false, that's peddled around us and repeated so often that it can be very tough just to get your bearings, which obviously we're trying to combat with podcasts like this and materials and resources and insights such as you're providing. So this is really good for fellow Christians to hear. And I really like the point that you made of these Christians that didn't just sit around and wait for the end. There have been so many times, this is another good reason for us to know our history. There have been so many times throughout the history of the church that it looked bleak. It looked without hope. It was over, game over, done, put a fork in it, and the kingdom continued to expand. Sometimes it did go through terrible persecutions. You know, Central Asia today has essentially wiped out any remnant of the ancient church. You walk around the mountains of Afghanistan, you're not going to see relics of churches in the 6th century, but they were there. There were bishoprics in Afghanistan, but the kingdom continues to advance. And that's so important for us to apply in our own lives today. Yeah, there's some scary things peddling by on the headlines and the news tickers, but our job is to be faithful. We don't know exactly how things play. We're just called to be faithful and to take our steps. And like you said, to encourage one another, to fellowship with one another, to have joy in our lives, to raise up children in the fear, the love, the admonition of the Lord, and just to see what he does through all of this, through his church.
A good analogy to this, and to be fair, most conservative Christians like myself, maybe yourself as well, maybe your listeners, we criticize the COVID maniac people for pretending like this was anything like the Black Death of the past, which is just nonsense. Sometimes we, and again, to be conservative, sometimes we can be guilty of, again, of a doomsday kind of thing, saying this is the worst persecution the church has ever known. It's like, well, not really. I mean, you don't have to go back to the early church. You can just look at the Soviet Union before the wall went down, or look at Nigeria today. I mean, you do understand that more Christians were killed for their faith in the 20th century than all of the centuries put together, including the first century. Okay, Muslim nations and atheist nations have killed far more Christians than the Romans ever did. So we need that perspective as well. But again, it is. And, I like Doug Wilson and his folks, those guys, they're what are called post-millennialists. I don't know if you're familiar with that. In the 19th century, post-millennialists were the liberals. They thought man was going to build utopia. But there is a, believe it or not, as I learned only 5 years ago, an evangelical conservative orthodox understanding of post-millennialism, that God is using the church to slowly build the temple, to spread the gospel. And again, we live much better lives than people did in the past, even the near past, in so many different ways. So we do have cause to be excited. We began this by talking about how we met at the Association of Classical Christian Schools. I'm more optimistic than most because I get to speak all over the country at these classical schools. And wherever I go, Andy, it's the same spirit of joy, of wonder, of gratitude, of wanting to. I mean, it's there. We're not Europe. We're still a Christian nation. Everywhere you go, it's just the top people on top make a lot of noise. But we are doing the slow grassroots movement work. I mean, anybody that has four children and raises them in the fear, admonition, and joy of the Lord is doing something just as important as working in politics. And that's going to be the change from the grassroots up. If you only have one kid, raise them up. But if God gives you four kids, raise them up and be salt and light in the world.
Yeah, and be content and know things move slow sometimes. It takes a long time for that yeast to work through the dough, and that's fine. We just are called to be faithful and to take our steps. And yeah, there is joy that comes from all of that. If we can just free ourselves from, you know, only looking at the trials around us, free ourselves from only staring at social media or all that's going wrong, we can really focus on our families, our churches, one another, the Word, the Spirit that's always with us. There's so much good. And that's another reason why history, a historical perspective like you're sharing, is helpful for us, because it puts things in context. It puts things in perspective. All of a sudden, our present circumstances are not nearly as bleak as we might have imagined, because we get to see what other believers have walked through and marched through in really dark chapters of history and prevailed. So that, I'm so grateful for your voice and your perspective.
Maybe we can end with the phrase from World War II in Britain: keep calm and carry on.
Amen. That's right. Well, for any of our listeners, as we're wrapping up, if they want to, if they're intrigued by what they're hearing, their interest is piqued, what are some resources that they can go and find, that they can get their hands on, digest, and learn about the early church or this time period that you're referring to?
I mean, the best way, like I said, if you go to just go to Amazon.com, type in my name, Louis Marcos, M-A-R-K-O-S. You'll see all my books there. I've got a new one called Ancient Voices, An Insider's Look at the Early Church. And in there, I talk about all the stuff that we're talking about here and try to listen to their voice and hear them at the same time.
Well, I will make sure that that gets into our show notes. So anybody that's listening, you can go and check it out there. But Professor Marcos, I can't thank you enough for your time and all the energy that you've poured into this and all that you're doing for the kingdom.
Hey, well, thanks for having me on. We'll have to do it again.
We have to do it again. All right. Thank you, sir. Take care. Thank you for joining us today for the Christian Emergency Podcast. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe and give us a 5-star review. Also, tell your friends about us and ask them to subscribe as well. To learn more about the Christian Emergency Alliance or financially invest in our ministry, visit us at www.christianemergency.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you again for listening, and stand strong out there.